The city of Phoenix has grown dramatically over the past several decades, but what's going to make it stand out in the next generation? I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton about his plans for the city's future in areas including economic development and transportation. Also, is a new downtown arena on the horizon, maybe one that will house both the Phoenix Suns and the Arizona Coyotes. Plus, former President Jimmy Carter is 90 years old. In his new book, A Full Life, he looks back at his formative years and his one term in the White House. I'll ask Carter about his proudest accomplishments, as well as what the U.S. should be doing to encourage peace in the Middle East. Also, Masa Inoshita was a young man when his family was placed in an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. In his later years, Inoshita worked to educate young people about the circumstances. We'll look back on the impact of Inoshita, who died earlier this month. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A University of Cincinnati police officer who fatally shot a driver during a traffic stop has been indicted on murder charges. Officer Ray Tensing, who is white, had stopped Samuel DeBose, who's black, because he was missing a front license plate. Tensing says he had to shoot because DeBose took off, dragging him with a car. Hamilton County Prosecutor Joseph Dieter says these types of incidents have got to stop.
I was shocked. I realized what this was going to mean to our community, and it really broke my heart because I know it's just bad.
The defense attorney in the case says given the evidence presented, he doesn't believe there should be an indictment against the officer. Federal authorities have indicted Philadelphia Congressman Chaka Fetah on political corruption charges. Dave Davies from member station WHYY has more.
The 20-year congressman is charged with racketeering, conspiracy, bribery, and other charges. Authorities say Fetah orchestrated a scheme to repay $600,000 of an illegal campaign loan using charitable and federal grant funds. They also charge he tapped campaign funds to pay his son's college debt and tried to get an ambassadorship for Herb Wiederman, a former deputy mayor of Philadelphia who gave him money and things of value. Four others are charged, including Wiederman. Some of the allegations have appeared in earlier court filings, and Fetah has insisted he's done nothing wrong. For NPR News, I'm Dave Davies in Philadelphia.
In Zimbabwe, two men accused of helping an American sport hunter kill a protected lion known as Cecil are out on bail. The hunter, who's from Minnesota, has not been charged. NPR's Ophebia Quistarton has more.
Cecil the lion, with his distinctive black mane, was a popular feature at Hwange National Park in Zimbabwe. Minnesota-based dentist Walter Palmer allegedly paid $50,000 to bow hunt Cecil. Palmer, who's known for trophy hunting, has issued a statement saying he regrets killing the lion and relied on the expertise of professional local guides to ensure the hunt was legal. He says he had no idea that the lion was a local favorite until the hunt was over and was not aware that Cecil wore a special collar as part of research at Oxford University. The lion was allegedly lured from the protected park before being killed. Ophebia Quistarton, NPR News, Dakar.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it will assist Zimbabwe officials in whatever manner requested. The world economy is recovering but remains fragile. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde today described the United States as a strong performer and China as resilient despite a recent drop in Chinese stock prices. On Wall Street, stocks are trading higher at this hour. The Dow is up 89 points, the Nasdaq up 3, the S&P 500 up 9 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting Wikipedia and the Digital Public Library of America through its Universal Access to Knowledge program, working to facilitate the openness and accessibility of all knowledge at sloan.org.
Good morning. From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. A new report finds Arizona near the bottom of all states for the quality of public school education. The financial advice website WalletHub looked at what it called key metrics to determine the states with the top-performing schools. The closest Arizona came to the national average was in SAT test scores, with the state ranking number 27. But Arizona was 32nd in the number of graduates who completed an advanced placement exam while in high school. math test scores were 36th in the nation, with the average reading scores for Arizona students at number 46. Gubernatorial spokesman Daniel Scarpinato, though, says his boss is focused on education, if for no other reason than the state's long-term prosperity.
The way you attract good companies to our state is by having a qualified workforce, but also having great schools where people want to come to our state so they can send their kids to those schools.
Scarpinato says at least part of the problem is money, saying that's why the governor wants to ask voters next year to tap state land trust proceeds to boost funding.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. The Navajo Nation's only nursing home, which caters to nearly 80 elderly patients, is at risk of being shut down, as the facility faces a large fine over safety code violations. The Gallup Independent reports the Chinle Nursing Home CEO says the violations center around the facility's aged building, which doesn't meet Medicaid services requirements. In a statement, Navajo Nation President Russell Begay says there are plans to build a new nursing home that could serve up to 120 Navajo elders.
A cloudy day today in the valley, a chance for some rain. We're expecting a high near 104 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow, still a chance for some rain. The high expected to be 102 and then back up to 107 on Friday.
KJZZ is supported by the ASU Surplus Store, featuring office furniture and supplies, refurbished computers, and more. Open to the public Monday to Friday, noon to 4, and now open Saturday, 8 a.m. till noon. Rio Salado in the Loop 101 in Tempe.
Right now, under cloudy skies, it's 93 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, President Jimmy Carter is 90 years old, and he writes about many of them in his new book, A Full Life. I'll talk with him about his one term in the White House, race relations, and what he thinks it will take to establish peace in the Middle East. Plus, Masa Inoshita was a young man when his family was placed in an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. In his later years, Inoshita worked to educate young people about the circumstances. We'll look back on the impact of Inoshita, who died earlier this month. And the Arizona Cardinals report for training camp later this week with high expectations. Could a Super Bowl be in the offing? I'll ask Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic. We start today's program with Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, who's in the midst of a re-election run against Matt Jetty and Anna Brennan. Welcome, Mayor.
Steve, it's great to be here.
You have been very out front on Proposition 104, transportation projects. Why are you so enthusiastic about it?
Well, because I'm a big believer in the importance of public transportation. I believe that you can't create a great city unless you have great multimodal options for people. And the reason is, I lived it. I grew up in West Phoenix in a working class family. My dad, who sold shoes at JCPenney at Park Central Mall in Central Phoenix. Hopefully some of your listeners will remember when there was a JCPenney at Park Central Mall in Central Phoenix and later at Christown. He took that city bus and we were able to put food on our table and get me through college and the four Stanton kids through college and me through law school on a working salesman's salary because of the availability of public transportation. So I believe in it. I understand that hundreds of thousands of people in Phoenix and throughout the valley are able to get an education, get to their jobs, get to their doctor's appointment because of public transportation. And if we want to continue to grow our economy, growing multimodal options for the people of the city is critically important.
How big a role can light rail play in that? Light rail has been a success. People are very enthusiastic about it, but those who are not are saying it just doesn't go far enough. What it serves well. Can Prop 104 help with that? How long a time frame are we looking at until light rail really affects a greater part of Phoenix?
Well, first off, light rail has been a tremendous success. Obviously much more successful than even we originally projected when the citizens of Phoenix overwhelmingly supported Transit 2000 back in the year 2000. And that has paid tremendous dividends to this community, not only including ridership, but the economic development benefits. Billions and billions of dollars. We just released a report yesterday, over $8 billion of investment along the light rail line in Phoenix and Tempe. And oh, by the way, I can't wait till Mesa goes into downtown Mesa and Central Mesa. I want them to be hugely successful and also get the massive economic development benefits of it as well. So it's been a huge success by any measure. And the reality is that was just the original backbone of the system. Now we got to build out the rest of the system. You know, New York subway system had to start somewhere, and in Phoenix we're just beginning that process. When the voters of Phoenix overwhelmingly support Prop 104, and I believe they will, It's a 35-year plan, and it involves a tripling of light rail. Even some of the critics will say, well, wait a minute, it's too focused in on Central Phoenix. Well, that's because that's where the current line is. Now we're taking it out to many other parts of the city, South Phoenix, West Phoenix and Maryvale, the Metro Center area where I happen to grow up in Northwest Phoenix, even over to Paradise Valley Mall. And one of the great things about it is it will connect people directly to so many educational institutions. Let me give you an example. If you're a young person right now growing up in South Phoenix, when light rail is built down Central Avenue to Baseline, you can jump on that light rail. And if you choose to go to ASU in Tempe, the option's there. Mm-hmm. If you choose to go to one of the new higher education offerings in Mesa, it'll be right along light rail. If you want to go to Gateway Community College, it'll be on light rail. ASU downtown, U of A Medical School, Grand Canyon University, the fastest growing university in the United States of America is in West Phoenix. Grand Canyon University or ASU West will all be connected. And for families like mine that couldn't afford two cars, the ability to have great public transportation directly connect you to higher education may be the difference between a child getting a higher education or not. Mm-hmm. So if you believe in education, I do. If you believe in education, great public transportation goes hand in hand with higher education.
You mentioned economic development, which is huge for all the communities around the Valley. Can Phoenix be a leader when it comes to that and have it benefit Phoenix but also the surrounding cities? There's also a concern, Mayor, too, which has been going on for decades, not just since you've been in office, that where are the corporate headquarters? Why doesn't Phoenix have more of those? Because everyone loves small businesses, of course, but what will it take for the small businesses to be the big dog on the block and create thousands of jobs?
Well, my relentless focus in my 4 years in office, and if I'm lucky enough to get four more years, will continue to be my relentless focus, is to build a more innovative economy and a more export-based economy. Look, like all cities across the United States, often your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. We are the fastest growing big city post-World War II in the United States of America. We're big. We're the fifth largest city in the United States in terms of population, but we haven't been big that long because we've grown so fast. Mm-hmm. And growth has been good for this community. Now, we can't build an entire economy based on growth. You got to have a more diverse, sustainable, long-term economy that will allow us to compete in this hyper-competitive international economy. So the advantage of Phoenix is that we're new. And so if you want to take a leadership role in this community, there's no old boy network holding you back. If there was, I wouldn't be mayor of this city. It's wide open. Most people are from someplace else. Leadership opportunities are there for the taking. We don't have a lot of the older institutions like a lot of other cities. Many of the corporate headquarters that you might describe have been located in their current location for a long period of time. What we need to do is support our entrepreneurs that are here. The future, you know, big headquarters are not going to come from some company pulling up stakes and moving from, you know, an East Coast city to Phoenix, Arizona. The future large headquarter companies are located here now in terms of the entrepreneurs beginning their businesses. They're the Web PTs of the world, which is a incredibly fast-growing and successful tech company located in the Warehouse District. You know, supporting our entrepreneurs, making sure we have an entrepreneurial ecosystem that involves supporting people that want to start their own companies, having the education system, having the workforce, having the investment opportunities to provide capital for these companies, creating that ecosystem. That's how we're going to create those large headquarter companies, supporting our local entrepreneurs. And we've done a great job in Phoenix, Arizona, making sure we're building that entrepreneurial ecosystem.
Based on where Phoenix is, and I'll broaden this out, and even just the state, it was hit extremely hard, of course, by the recession, even more so than many other communities. And there's a feeling that, as you mentioned, Phoenix is a younger place, and there are openings for other things. But what about the power that comes from having those really big, expansive ideas? Do we have leadership, whether it's yourself, whether it's others, working together for big things? Or is the world the way it is now because we have to make incremental shifts? Because I think there are people who kind of want you to say, we're going to do this enormous thing, and I'm going to lead this pack, as opposed to saying, I'm going to keep focus, we're going to make it work, it's going to be good.
Well, I think the pathway to ensure that Phoenix can take its rightful place as one of the leading cities in the United States of America, one of the leading cities on this globe, it's there for the taking. I'm an optimist. I believe that if we make the right policy choices, Phoenix, which is has the highest quality of life bar none of any city in the United States of America, people are moving here for a reason, can take its rightful place as an economic leader if we make the right policy choices. We need to make sure, of course, we got to do a better job of supporting education and increasing college attainment among our young people. We have to make Phoenix an attractive place so that higher educated people from around the country choose to make Phoenix their home, not just because they like the lifestyle, but because they know they can have a career second to none. We need to invest in innovation, as Phoenix has done. We need to build a more export-based economy, because those cities that have a higher percentage of their economy and jobs based upon exporting are the leading economies. Phoenix is a little bit behind, but you know what? We're going to catch up. So I'm going to continue to have a relentless focus on building an export-based economy. It's the reason why we opened up a trade and investment office in Mexico City. It's the reason why we're having things like export boot camps, in which local companies can get free training from the city of Phoenix about how to do business across the globe. The legal situation, cultural situation, all the things that a company and entrepreneur would need. And by the way, it's not just products. It's services. We have advanced business services as a big part of our local economy, and that's something that we can provide to companies and people around this globe. It's one of our competitive advantages, and we need to take better advantage of what we've got and export that. So building an export-based economy is a huge part of what I'll be working on for the next 4 years, and that's how we're going to take our rightful place as one of not just leading lifestyle communities, but also leading economic communities in the United States of America. I wish we could have this conversation 10 years from now. Save this tape and have you back in 10 years, and I think you'll say that we made the right policy choices, and you'll see that Phoenix will have a much higher profile as an economic leader in this country.
I think people might wonder in 10 years whether you'll be in Washington, D.C. or Phoenix, Mayor, but we'll get to that at some other point. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few minutes left with the mayor of Phoenix, Greg Stanton. Mayor, there's been talk by some members of the council, that maybe a new downtown arena is in the offing. Suns owner Robert Sarver would like something like that. We hear, and the Coyotes, of course, having their issues with Glendale. Is that a good idea to have a new downtown arena, and is there the money to pay for it?
Well, first, Mr. Sarver and the Phoenix Suns have been great partners with the city of Phoenix, and our relationship with the Phoenix Suns, dating back decades, has been a wonderful, wonderful relationship. I am a huge fan, so I'll admit my bias. I grew up in the city of Phoenix, and my best memories of as a kid were my dad and I and my brother and sisters in our living room listening to Al McCoy high-fiving each other as Walter Davis or Alvin Adams, you know, scored the winning hoop on a bucket. So, I mean, the Suns are in my heart. I love them. Now, moving forward, we need to make sure that that relationship between the Phoenix Suns and the city of Phoenix stays as strong as ever. So, obviously, we're working very closely with the Suns, and we'll soon be entering into discussions about the future of the arena. That relationship has been an outstanding one. We've made major improvements to the existing arena, and it stood the test of time. I love going to Mercury games or Rattler games or concerts and events at that arena, but we also have to realize that we got to make sure that our teams can stay competitive. We want them to be in the best position as they can to be competitive in their league and win championships. So, you know, in terms of detailed negotiations, we're just beginning that process. But I'm obviously open-minded to work as closely as I can with the Suns. Now, as it relates to the Coyotes, as you know, they just recently worked out an agreement with the city of Glendale so that they'll be there for 2 years. So I think their immediate future is worked out. And it's important to me as mayor to protect and support our regional assets. And the Coyotes are certainly a regional asset. I want to make sure that not just the next 2 years, but their long-term future is secure here in the Valley of the Sun. And so as it relates to downtown, I'm totally open-minded to it. I want to work with the Coyotes and hopefully secure their future. You know, Mr. Sarver has been open-minded to have those discussions to at least see if there is a situation that will work out. And that's all I can ask for, is that people have an open mind as we enter into these discussion and negotiations. What I don't want is the Coyotes to go to Las Vegas or Canada or some other location. I want them to stay here and win multiple Stanley Cups and bring the cup home to Phoenix, Arizona. That would be an awesome thing. Of course, equally as much, I want, if not more, I want the Suns to bring home the NBA championship. And so I'm a fan as well as a mayor.
Mayor, we've got like a minute left. I want to make sure I get to this ruling related to so-called pension spiking, which the city's going to appeal. How much is pension reform potentially an albatross around the city's neck at this point?
Well, I think we've had a lot of success in that regard. I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about the level of success that we've had. We've done some significant pension reform, not just as a council, but as a community. We've put those items on the ballot, and the people of Phoenix have overwhelmingly supported smart pension reform. And what I mean by that is the choices that we have made as a community are going to save the city of Phoenix over $800 million over the next few decades. Mm-hmm. We took some tough steps in terms of eliminating pension spiking. One of them, and it's hard to explain in a short format like this, but I'll do the best I can, was we took a snapshot approach, meaning that any benefit that a city employee had accrued up to that moment in time, we weren't going to take away, we weren't going to claw back, but they weren't going to be able to accrue new benefits for pension spiking moving forward. That's what the court said was illegal, that mm-hmm. even moving forward, we couldn't do, though. That's why I said we're going to appeal that, because I do believe that we struck the right balance when it came to changes to a pension spike and eliminating pension spiking. We want to make sure I love our city employees. I want to make sure they have retirement security, but we also need to have a sustainable system. And I think the choices that Phoenix has made has balanced those interests very well. And I might politely suggest to the governor and the legislature as they go through the important process of public safety pension reform for police and fire, which is going to be an incredibly challenging issue, that they look to the models that the city of Phoenix has done. I think we've shown leadership, and they can use those models for success in the public safety pension reform as well.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
It is always great to be here, Steve. I hope to do it many times for the next 4 years.
Still to come on Here and Now, former President Jimmy Carter joins us to talk about his life, his term in the presidency, and also peace in the Middle East. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, together with the U.S. Oncology Network, united to redefine cancer care, working collaboratively with patients' primary physicians to ensure the highest continuity of care. More at ArizonaOncology.com.
You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us today at 1 for NewsHour from the BBC. Well, cloudy skies across much of Arizona right now. It's 79 degrees in Tucson, 90 in Casa Grande. Cloudy skies, 92 degrees in Yuma. It's 81 in Prescott and 76 in Flagstaff. You rely on KJZZ for the news. And now with our new online store, you can rely on KJZZ for all your gift-giving needs. Our new KJZZ shop has the t-shirts and backpacks that you and your friends will want to show off. And each purchase supports the station. You can find out more at yourshop.kjzz.org. With relative humidity at 35%, we have cloudy skies over Phoenix and 93 degrees at 1122.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're gearing up for another presidential campaign. Already nearly 20 Republican and Democratic candidates have announced they're running. But can any of them be strong leaders and effective agents of change? One man who went from relative unknown to the White House with an ambitious agenda is Jimmy Carter. He was elected in 1976 and served one term. His post-presidential accomplishments have been incomparably productive and impactful. Now at the age of 90, he looks back on his formative years and political career in a new book called A Full Life. President Carter will be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe Friday night at 7. President Carter, welcome. What do you make of all these people who think they can be president? We've got nearly 20 people running. Is that a good sign or something else?
Well, I had about a dozen that ran against me in 1976, including President Ford and Ronald Reagan on the other side. So there were about 14 in all. So I don't think this is an extraordinary number. And, of course, they'll be weaned out pretty rapidly because nowadays the main crux of staying in the race is raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And as you know, that's going to be limited to a small number of Republicans and Democrats.
You'd worked so hard to try to achieve peace in the Middle East between Egypt and Israel at that time. What does it take? Is there a true possibility of achieving a lasting peace in the Middle East? And what would it take? What factors would need to occur for that to happen?
Well, I would say that now is the lowest point in my political career time that we've ever seen in the prospects for an immediate progress being made between Israel and its immediate neighbors, that is primarily the Palestinians. The United States has practically no influence in either Jerusalem or in Ramallah or Gaza. And we don't have any inclination, apparently, on the part of the Israeli government now to take the initiative toward peace relating to the Palestinians. So I would say that it's more of a dormant relationship now than I remember in my lifetime. We don't have any move by other people, particularly the European countries, to replace the United States as the interlocutor or the mediator. And I think the Netanyahu government has made it plain, with this, particularly with this newly formed, more conservative government, that they don't have any inclination to move toward a two-state solution, which was a premise or the assumption that we would have back in those days. So I think I had a much better prospect when I became president to make some progress than seems to exist at this moment.
What do you think of the nuclear deal with Iran, and how could that affect the Middle East situation overall?
I think it could be very helpful. I'm fully in favor of it. I believe it's a wonderful agreement there on the part of the United States of America, the entire world, and even the Iranians. And my hope is that it'll be go into effect and that the Congress will not be able to veto what John Kerry has done so assiduously and so well. I have complete confidence in John Kerry's negotiating ability and also his toughness. And his when he tells me that he has an agreement and if Iran violates it, they'll be severely punished by an immediate imposition of the economic sanctions, I believe him completely. And I think that we have the agreement that can make this come about, no matter what other countries might think about it.
None of us can be psychiatrists in this situation, but for people who came of age in the late 70s, early 80s, when we first saw the face of Ayatollah Khomeini and how terrifying that was to people, does it make sense to you that there are some people who, when they hear anything with Iran, they're wary?
I don't think it's incorrect to be wary. I wouldn't say that we need to trust Iran, but I think with the agreement that has now been consummated, at least by the executive branch of our government, and by the Europeans, and by China, and by Russia as well, we have a very good measuring stick on whether Iran violates the agreement that they've reached. So I think we have a very good situation. When the Shah was overthrown in Iran when I was in office, which was a surprise to all the intelligence agencies and to the general public, I immediately established diplomatic relations with the Ayatollah's revolutionary government. And it was those diplomats that I sent over to Tehran that were captured and made prisoner. They had an almost equal number that they had sent over to Washington to represent them and our country. So we immediately established diplomatic relations with Iran when the Shah was overthrown.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with former President Jimmy Carter. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix Friday night at 7 with his new book. It looks back on his formative years and his political career. It's called A Full Life. Now, President Carter, your post-presidential commitments and accomplishments have been far-reaching. You're considered to be the most impressive former president after your four-year presidential term had happened. How do you measure the criticism you received in one position and the high praise you receive in another? Is that just human nature? How do you explain that?
Well, there was a lot of praise when I was president, too, when we normalized diplomatic relations with China, when we consummated the Panama Peace Agreement, when we started doing away with apartheid in South Africa, when we got peace between Israel and Egypt, when we formed a very strong and active energy policy that was kind of comprehensive in nature, when we dealt with the Alaska lands problems. All of those were notable achievements, but the main thing was that we had the Iran hostage crisis, which I could not resolve early in my term. And the last 3 days I was president, I never went to bed at all, never tried to go to bed. I just negotiated constantly with Iran and about 12 other countries. And we got an agreement from the Iranians that they would release all our hostages. They were in an airplane at the end of their runway in Tehran, ready to take off from early that morning. But for some reason, which I never have tried to explain, the Ayatollah kept them in prison in Iran in an airplane until after I was no longer president. So there were a lot of things that came up, but I think in general we had enough successes when I was in office, and also some issues that I tried to address unsuccessfully, which I've mentioned very meticulously in the new book I've written.
President Carter, I don't know if you would have seen a new play, a relatively new play called Five Presidents, and it fictionalizes what could have happened when you and the other four living presidents were at President Nixon's funeral. There's an example of just having the five of you, or anyone who's ever been president, having that the knowledge that none of the rest of us will ever have, and the experience you go through. You talk about not sleeping, trying to negotiate to get the hostages out, when different presidents have sent men and women into war, and what that feels like when you find out people have died. Can any of us who haven't been president actually understand what it's like to have been president?
I doubt that. You know, we all go through trying and exciting and challenging and adventurous, unpredictable times. I was determined to keep our country at peace while I was in office, and I was lucky enough to be able to do it. When I was in the White House, we never dropped a bomb, we never launched a missile, we never fired a bullet at another country, another people, and that's one of the rare times that's happened. But I think that every president, when he goes into office, would like to keep our country at peace and would like to honor human rights and would like to meet the major challenges that arise. And we are all different from one another. We're just as different as, you know, five different people you might meet on the street. And when we get in office, we have challenges to meet. And that's what I try to do in this book, is not only tell about some of the lessons I've learned in my life, but maybe some of the lessons will be beneficial to people that read the book. And one of the things I do is delineate all the things that I was able to completely resolve when I was president, and some of the things that I was not able to resolve. And also described at the end of the book my relationship personally with all the presidents that served before me that I knew, and also those that have served since I left the White House. So the book is jam full of things that I believe our country could do. I think I also describe what a superpower should do and what our country should have as its present commitments for the future.
Well, what are some of the responsibilities of the superpower?
I think our country is capable and should strive to be a champion of peace, not war. I think we should be a champion of democracy and freedom. We should be a champion of the quality of the environment in dealing with global warming and other challenges that arise. Be also a champion of human rights. And we should set an example among the rich nations of the world in sharing as much of our resources as is good for us and for poor people with those who are in need. So those are the championships that our superpower should exemplify, set an example for other nations to emulate.
In terms of public life, can you explain to us what you want your legacy to be, what you most want to be remembered for, in terms of not what your family remembers about you, but what the broader public would remember about you?
One is peace and human rights. I think that after the Second World War, the international community reached a pinnacle of ambition to exemplify in public life the basic moral principles of all the great religions, and also the moral principles that an average person has. And that was done with the United Nations commitment to have peace instead of war, and also the passage of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights a few years later, which I think was the highest possible expression of the ideals of human behavior. So those two things are what I've tried to champion in my life in public office and also since I left the White House about 35 years ago.
You've been very open about your religious faith and spirituality. You obviously were when you were running for president. It seems like such an important part now of every candidate. Do you think that should be important when voters are considering whom to vote for? Because we'll hear from some critics who feel like, well, it's out there because some candidates feel like they have to say it, and yet there are some who feel it's a little bit disingenuous among some.
I tried to avoid it, as a matter of fact, but I was asked a question when I was campaigning in North Carolina, and I answered it, and of course the news media thought that I was a weirdo or something, that I got my instructions from heaven and things of that kind. But when I got to be president, I implemented quite severely the principle that I had learned as a child from my father, and that is a complete separation of church and state. So I terminated the policy then of inviting Billy Graham and other famous preachers into the White House, and I very carefully drew a delineation or a line between my role as a private worshiper in the nearest Baptist church to the White House and my role as a president. And I never have thought that any president should espouse the United States as a Christian nation or things of that kind. I think we should treat everybody in our country, whether they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, or even has no belief, on an equal basis.
President Carter, certainly the nation has made major strides when it comes to race relations, but we've seen recently very publicly that there are still many, many more obstacles to overcome when it comes to that. How did your childhood influence how you feel about race relations, and what do you see in today's world?
I grew up in a community called Archery, and I was the only white boy that lived in that area. I had about 200 African Americans who lived in Archery as well. And so all of my playmates, all my friends were African American, and the people with whom I worked in the fields were African American. My mother was a registered nurse, and she had to be gone a lot, sometimes all night long. And so I was raised in an African culture, you might say. My mother didn't pay any attention to the racial discrimination of that time, which was a custom all over the country. Because she was in the medical profession, she could get away with it. But she treated black and white people the same. One of the few people that I knew. But that's where I learned early on that it was getting rid of a millstone around the neck of both black and white people to do away with white superiority. And I think that later on, when we finally passed the Civil Rights Act, about 100 years after the war between the states was over in 1965 or so, we kind of breathed a sigh of relief and said, well, we've finally gotten rid of the problem of racial discrimination. And I think the recent news reports to which you refer have wakened us up to the fact that we still have a long way to go. There's still a great deal of discrimination against people who are poor inherently, have born poor and their parents are poor, and those who are African American or maybe Hispanic as well. We need to go more and more toward a complete American commitment, both in public life and private life, to do away with any sort of discrimination against somebody because of what their skin is colored or what kind of situation they were born into with their parents.
Do you think we're going to get there with younger generations? Do you think it's a lot about education?
Well, I've been a professor at Emory University in Atlanta for 33 years. I'm starting my 34th year next month. And so I'm constantly in touch with the younger generation. Also, I have 12 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren of my own. But I think there's a lot different attitude among the very young people in our country and the older people who still cling, some of them at least, not all of them, of course, but a few of them cling to the principle that whites are superior and deserve a better opportunity for jobs and education and things of that kind. I think there's a lot of hope in the younger generation, yes.
Former President Jimmy Carter, his new book is called A Full Life. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. That's on Friday night at 7. President Carter, an honor to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I've enjoyed it very much, and it's nice to talk to you and all the people around Phoenix, I guess the rest of the state.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In 2014, the Arizona Cardinals got off to a tremendous start, but quarterback injuries and a tiring defense led to a disappointing finish and a first-round playoff loss to the Carolina Panthers. The offseason's been busy, with the team strengthening its offensive line while losing its defensive coordinator to the New York Jets. With players reporting for camp later this week, I'm joined by Kent Summers of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports, who's been covering the Cardinals for more than two decades. Kent, good morning.
Good morning.
I won't ask you about Middle East policy or race relations or anything. We'll dive right into football, okay?
I'm a little intimidated following President Carter. This is an interesting segue.
I know. So what's the most important move the Cardinals have made in the offseason?
The most important, move I think that will affect their fortunes on the field is probably the upgrading of the offensive line, signing a guard, Mike Iupati, who's been to a couple Pro Bowls while he was with the 49ers, and it should be a better offensive line than they've had in quite some time.
So what did the organization learn from last year's late-season disappointment? I know a lot of it had to do with quarterback injuries, but were there other things they could have done, or was that just too difficult to overcome?
I think overall that was too difficult to overcome. It's bad enough to lose your starter, Carson Palmer. They're 16-6. When he starts games over the last 2 years, they've won 13 of their last 15. When he starts, that Drew Stanton's a competent backup, but then he gets hurt. And any team in the league, when you're down to your third quarterback, you're in deep trouble. Usually when you're down to your second one, you're in trouble. I think maybe something was learned that I think later in the year there were some injuries, certain injuries to players, hamstrings, what they refer to as soft tissue injuries. I think as they look back, I think they will adjust how hard they work certain players early in the season, hoping that they don't have durability questions later. For instance, maybe somebody like Larry Fitzgerald, the receiver who turns 32 at the end of August, I think, his workload could be managed in a better way so he could stay healthy an entire season. Little tweaks like that. But overall, any NFL team loses its starting quarterback, it's very difficult to overcome.
So what are you watching really closely as camp gets ready to start? I know when you're a beat guy and you're a writer as you are, I don't know if it's the editors or you just want to do this. There's always kind of the expectations of sort of five things I'm looking at. Are there a couple you could share with us?
I'm interested in looking at the team's running back situation. Andre Ellington, dealt with a foot injury for most of the season and then had to end it early when he had a sports hernia. They would like to get somebody bigger to complement him. They think they did that in David Johnson, a third-round pick out of Northern Iowa. How that position shapes up is going to be really interesting to me. They're not terribly deep at tight end. They just signed one this week, Jermaine Gresham, who played with Cincinnati. He's coming off back surgery. He should be able to help. I think one of the overarching themes, too, is on the other side of the ball. Defensively, they lost coordinator Todd Bowles, who became the head coach of the Jets. And replacing him is the former outside linebackers coach, James Betcher, who is, I think, a charismatic, intelligent guy. But he's only 37. He's only been in the league 4 years, and he's never coordinated a defense at any level. So I think how players react to him, how that defense performs, because these guys had the utmost confidence in Bowles. They really bought into everything he ever asked them to do, and that's very difficult to replace, and Betcher's walking into a difficult situation.
Okay, Kent, here's an unfair question for you. If relatively healthy, can this team make a Super Bowl run?
Yes, I can. I think if Carson Palmer stays healthy, they can make a Super Bowl run. I don't think there's any question. It probably sounds like a homer, and I'll throw the caveat in there that I've been as critical as this team over the years as anyone, and seen a lot of 4-12 seasons. But as they enter camp, I think this is the most talent that this team has had. It's deeper at every position than it's been pretty much since I've covered the team. It's all going to come down, I think, to the two things we talked about: Palmer's health. And how does that defense respond to James Betcher?
And, Kent, final thing, head coach Bruce Arians has received a lot of positive attention, got even more yesterday when he announced Jen Welter, first female who's going to be a coaching intern during the preseason. He's an old-school guy, but he's also known for being creative and glib. Is his impact one of the main reasons this team has turned it around over the last couple of years? I mean, certainly the general manager, Steve Keim, should get credit for bringing in better players. But is Arians one of those special guys?
I think he is. He had instant credibility with players. He's one of those unique guys who has an ability to coach very hard, to be very hard on players on the field, to scream and yell, and then to put his arm around them as they walk off the field, and everybody's fine with it. There's no holdover, And he just coaches to his personality, and I think the guys realize that he's genuine, and they can talk to him. And he is creative. He is creative, and I think he's, surrounded himself with creative, strong people. I mean, and now he's built a coaching staff that includes people in their 20s, one in their 80s, and then an intern through training camp, the first female coach in NFL history.
Kent Summers, who covers the Arizona Cardinals and has for a couple of decades for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. Kent, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at the impact of the Book of Mormon opening in Salt Lake City, and also we'll remember Mas Enoshita. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Smart Document Solutions. For 27 years, acting as a Xerox authorized sales agent, providing the entire portfolio of Xerox document solutions, including equipment, service, and fleet management. azsmartoffice.com.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Cloudy skies, chance of showers today in the valley. We're looking for a high near 104 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy overnight, a low in the mid-80s, an even better chance for some rain tonight, a high of 102 tomorrow. NPR's Here and Now starts at 12. The House and Senate are debating highway funding bills, and some senators are criticizing the House for not passing a long-term highway bill, which it hasn't done in 10 years. And Boston's mayor is defending the decision not to pursue the 2024 Summer Olympics. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. We proudly recognize our Leadership Society member Deanne Griebel for her generous support of the KJZZ newsroom renovation. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8257. It's cloudy and 93 degrees in Phoenix at 11:45.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. One of Broadway's most popular musicals of the past decade is coming to the Valley later this year, and last night it made its debut in Salt Lake City, a place that many would view as a controversial location for staging The Book of Mormon, written by South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone. But how has the community responded to the musical opening in the heart of the LDS Church? Ellen Wiest is an arts writer for the Salt Lake Tribune and joins us for a few minutes. Hi, Ellen. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what is the lead-up to the premiere of The Book of Mormon been like in Salt Lake City among the public and among the arts community?
Well, first of all, I think it's been a long lead up. Our paper and all the entertainment writers have been writing about Book of Mormon since it launched on Broadway. We had our religion writer at the opening show, and so we've been writing about it for a long time. I think most people in the arts community, people who really care about this musical, have seen it in other cities first. And so I think it's the appeal now has spread beyond sort of the theater-going crowd to the general public. And I also think that audiences for this run are self-selected. A lot of people are choosing not to go see it, just as people who have been looking forward to it for years were first in line to get tickets. So I think it's kind of it says a lot about the bifurcated culture here in that sometimes things that are hits in other places play well here, and sometimes they only play to a certain part of the demographic.
So to paint with a broad brush, as you said, it's been building up for a while. The show has been out there for several years. Is there a feeling that maybe people who were upset about it at the time, as you said, will just choose not to see it? They're not as upset about it now as they might have been 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly the sense, is that, you know, most people know what it is, know about the level of profanity in the show, and know about the level of satire in the show. And so at this point, people are either embracing it, excited to see it here. There's a certain real provincial charm in seeing a Broadway touring musical that has your skyline as its set. And so I think there's a real kind of excitement and thrill about that. But I also think that people who are of the opinion that the Mormon religion shouldn't be satirized in this way are just staying away and not talking about it and not protesting.
So considering this is entertainment, for many at least, what is there about the balance, the seeming desire, I guess, to balance the satire with affection? I know that might be hard for some people from the LDS Church, but is there a feeling by many others that there is an effort there to entertain but also inform, maybe offend a little bit, but also be affectionate?
Yes. I mean, when our religion writer went to the original Broadway show, she was surprised at the sweetness of the Mormon portrayals. The missionaries who are the lead characters, of course, are very naive, but there's also some joy in the idea that this faith might be crazy, but look at the community that they've built, and that there's some idea at the end of the play that it doesn't matter what community you join, but having one is part of what the show is about. So anyway, I think people have found that kind of sweetness to the tone interesting. But of course, there are mainstream Mormons who wouldn't be able to see that and so will choose not to vote with their dollars on this one and just won't come to see the show.
Is there a history of theater and performing arts in Salt Lake City where performers have been able to satirize or parody the LDS Church or its members? Because I think those of us who
aren't in Salt Lake City might think, well, you know, of course they'd be sensitive. They wouldn't actually have allowed this kind of thing. But there is some kind of history of that, isn't there?
Right. There's a contemporary theater company in town called the Salt Lake Acting Company, and for 37 years they've produced an annual musical satirizing local culture. It's called Saturday's Voyeur. And for those who are longtime Mormon pop culture watchers, they might know that that name comes from a 1970s musical called Saturday's Voyeur that was very faith-promoting among Mormons. So that play every year plays for 3 months. It sells out. It takes on a lot of the Mormons among the legislature. It loves to satirize local politics. It loves to make fun of the dirty air that we sometimes have here. And so it criticizes a lot of local culture, but specifically has a sweet spot for making fun of the Mormon church and particularly Mormon missionaries. There's almost always a pair of gay Mormon missionaries in the show. And at the theater company, there's an urban legend. They really believe that Trey Parker and Matt Stone came to the show when they were in Salt Lake City doing their research for Book of Mormon. There's no evidence of that. No one, they've tracked through the tickets, and they can't find any names on the tickets. But they really believe that Saturday's Voyeur was part of sort of the ongoing research that the creators did. I think a lot of people outside of Salt Lake would be astounded at how this musical is popular. It's considered among many in the liberal and progressive communities to be kind of like a steam valve for living here. Mm-hmm. And it everything is available for satire. And so it's pretty interesting. And it's also interesting in terms of, for the theater company, that's how they fund their season of contemporary plays. That play draws many people who are theater virgins, as they like to call them, who wouldn't go see a live show for anything else, but they'll attend this every year. And it's what allows the theater company to produce contemporary plays that a lot of people wouldn't have heard of on their regular season. So it's a pretty fascinating local phenomenon of this satire that's built into sort of the arts world around here.
Ellen Wiest is an arts writer for the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been talking about the Book of Mormon opening in Salt Lake City. Ellen, thank you.
Sure. Can I say one more thing? We've been getting tweets from the cast members of Book of Mormon, and they're critiquing the audience, and they're saying they've never found an audience more willing to laugh, more eager to laugh. So I've been playing around with that all day. It's pretty fun.
Interesting. Okay. Ellen, thanks. Take care.
Thanks for your time. Bye.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order requiring all Japanese Americans to be arrested and interned. Two internment camps were built in Arizona, and one of its unfortunate prisoners was Masaji Yanoshita, who became a highly sought-after speaker over the past couple of decades to talk about what he and his family went through. Moss, as he was known, passed away earlier this month in Phoenix. And joining me to talk about the internment camps and Moss Yanoshita is Karen Leong, Associate Professor in Arizona State School of Social Transformation. Karen, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
I want to make sure we talk briefly about the historical background of the Japanese internment camps. Why were they put into effect? Why were there camps in Arizona, for example?
Well, the United States government, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, received significant political pressure from the Western states, legislatures, and the press about fears regarding people of Japanese ancestry after the bombing of Pearl Harbor because they were on the Pacific coast. And some of this was political, some of it was economic, some of it was simply just fear. But in responses, they decided to create military zones, to allow the military to create military zones and move them away from the coast where they said there were concerns about security, national security. What's interesting is that the Executive Order 9066 was only meant to apply to Japanese Americans, as the Attorney General of the time noted in the correspondence that was found much later. So it was actually a racist, or it was focused on racial identity in terms of who would be removed. So people from Germany and Italy, other than the leaders, were not going to be removed, people of German and Italian descent. And they were isolated in these camps until towards the end of the war, when the Supreme Court reversed its decision and ultimately said that these were unconstitutional camps to detain them.
And we're talking about Japanese Americans. I know that Moss, I have heard him speak in the past about how there were some of the Japanese Americans who were in these camps who were recruited to actually go fight for the U.S., and Moss was one of them. That must have been quite a pill to swallow.
It really was. Not for Moss himself. He was waiting to get work. There's not a whole bunch to do for him in the camps, he told us, because we did a number of oral histories with him. And so when they came looking for people who knew Japanese, and he said he had like fourth grade knowledge of Japanese when they sort of had him read from textbooks, they still thought it was good enough and brought him in for training to be part of this intelligence service, which people didn't really know about because it was their secret tool against Japan, the military. And it left a bitter taste for his family, he told us in his oral histories, that, you know, many people who volunteered for this military intelligence service sort of snuck out of camp in the middle of the night because it would be looked on unfavorably. Even though 2/3 of those in the camps were American citizens, it was still seen as, you know, you're doing something that could ultimately hurt family members on the other side of the Pacific as well.
For a country that seemed to have betrayed you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so there was... his family was ostracized after he disappeared and became part of the military intelligence service, and he never realized that was going to happen until after he came back and learned about it. He had no clue.
Karen, how many years later did Moss decide to share his story and the history of the camps with the public?
You know, I think a lot of it came out of the 1980s when there was a movement among the Japanese American community and their allies to make known what happened. So in the 1980s, there was attempts to get an apology for what happened. And this movement gained steam, and there was a wartime commission on the internment and relocation of Japanese Americans. And they released a report in 1983 that was pretty explosive. It included testimony and stories, personal stories of people who were interned. It recommended the United States government give an apology. And at that point is when people began to openly talk about it and people began to want to know about it. Moss was already talking to people before then about it. He was interested in, he went back to Gila River, you know, in the 50s and would sit there on the butte looking over where the camp was and just cry and think about it. But he really became a speaker and an educator in the 80s after this report came out and after sort of the nation increased its consciousness about what happened with World War II and the Japanese Americans.
For those who haven't heard Moss speak, can you tell us about his style and how he would approach people when he talked about it?
Wow. Well, you've heard him speak, and he is a master story. He was a master storyteller. He would combine both his personal experiences, which are incredibly moving, along with the history that other people had told him and that he that had been part of the movement, that was part of the educational outreach that was coming out as a result of scholars doing more archival research. And he made it so personal and compelling. I still remember when he talked about their neighbor in Santa Maria who came to the train to see his family off. His father had already been picked up and taken by the FBI, but when his family had to go to the assembly center in Tulare, this man, this immigrant man, was just saying how much he trusted their family, how much he knew them, and this was so wrong. And you could actually hear the man talking. You could feel the desperation when Moss had to sell his father's horses from the farm they were on for much less than it was worth because they had to get rid of everything before they had to report for the camps. And so there was this, he just had a way of helping people feel what it was like. He made it come alive. And he was also really a gentle person. He was not harsh with what he said, but in some ways he was more effective because of that.
So, Karen, finally, what do you see as the impact of of what Moss had to say. I mean, he spoke to classrooms and he spoke to people of all ages. I imagine this is a way of keeping this alive, and it must have had some impact, right?
Oh, he has taught so many generations of Arizonan students and teachers and community members of what it means to value freedom, what it means to defend the rights of the Constitution. And he's really made it clear that he made it clear in the stories he told and the message that we all are different, but that doesn't mean that we reject those who are Americans who are different than we are, that we need to always be conscious about our freedoms and what's at stake.
Karen Leong is associate professor at ASU School of Social Transformation. We've been talking about Masa Noshita, who passed away earlier this month. Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on today's program. And thank you very much for listening. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. If you missed any part of our program, want to hear it later on, please go online to the web at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.